Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CXXIX, Tiberius Gracchus and the Landless Masses. As it's becoming apparent, any system of government that has been around for long enough is going to develop its problems, and that is definitely the case with the Roman Republic. There was inequality between the ruling class and the common people, and if young Tiberius Gracchus is to take up the cause, what's the worst that could happen? Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus. He was the son of a man by the same name, and his mother was Cornelia, who was the subject of our previous podcast. He was born by 162 BCE. He's a very important figure, often seen as the beginning of a whole change in Roman society and Roman politics, hence the Scholard book from the Gracchi to Nero. Like, the Gracchi is the beginning of something, and Tiberius Gracchus is the elder of the two Gracchi.
I remember last year we did a series in Emperors of Rome called The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic, and we put the beginning of the end at 133 BCE. So his death is kind of like the start of the end of all these ideas and the start of new ideas.
Yeah, I think that although this is always a kind of a construct that historians use so we can have beginnings and endings,
And everything's nice and neat.
Yeah, to make things neat exactly in ways that real life isn't.
Historians like order. Who would have known?
There is some logic to this because much of what unravels later on, you can see is some kind of progression upon what Tiberius Gracchus was trying to do. By the same token, you could almost certainly argue, and would be able to more easily if we had more evidence, I think, that a lot of the forces he was dealing with were already coming into being. He's the one who starts to harness them, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, as we'll get into later on, maybe perhaps the land reform ideas did not begin with him.
Yeah. Well, certainly there had been recognition that there were problems before that and some small attempts to do something about it. But I guess the fact that Tiberius Gracchus's life is very dramatic and ends very dramatically, and so much of his life is shaped around the changes that he tries to bring in around land reform, mean that this is a very convenient starting point and that there is a rationale to it.
All right. Should we get our Gracchi on?
I didn't think you were really going to use that phrase.
Does sound slightly dodgy. Could go in the edit, but you never know. Okay, so at the open, we should probably put out there that our most important source for learning about Tiberius Gracchus and indeed his brother Gaius is the work of Plutarch. There are other sources.
Yes, so we have the biographies of both brothers. Another important source is Appian and his Civil Wars, as it's called, which tells us about the fall of the Republic.
Yeah. Plutarch was writing well after the fact.
He was, and Appian even slightly later. They're both very late 1st century CE and into the 2nd century even.
And what sort of family did Tiberius Gracchus come from?
He comes from an elite family, no doubt about it. Very well connected amongst that oligarchy that runs Rome. But they are, importantly, not a patrician family. The Sempronii are plebeian, and that means that he can hold that important plebeian role, tribune of the plebs, which he will. As we noted last time when we talked about Cornelia, his father, Cornelia's husband, dies quite early, so he is brought up basically by his mother. Mm-hmm. She takes charge of their education and gives them the very best education, bringing in Greek philosophers. There may even have been some connection with the Scipionic household, who, again, had links to the very best educators in the ancient world. Although, as we'll see, and even from the time of Tiberius's father, Tiberius, there was a certain friction with the Scipionic household politically.
So what do we know about Tiberius as a person? We get a good description initially from Plutarch, who is, we should say, comparing him to his brother Gaius and showing how different their personalities are.
Yeah, and you have to wonder whether he's kind of setting them up as chalk and cheese. Mm. And he has a whole paragraph describing Tiberius. In every single case, he seems to be the opposite of Gaius. Mm. And in each example that Plutarch gives, it seems that Tiberius is the more restrained of the two. He says even in the way he looks, cast of features and look and bearing, Tiberius was gentle and sedate, while Gaius was high-strung and vehement. And he goes on like this, and every single thing he describes about him, which is mostly about the way he speaks, his style of public speaking, very important for a Roman male. He's not melodramatic. He's not over the top.
He's simple and plain.
Yeah. More agreeable, more conducive to pity. Not kind of upbeat and dramatic and over the top. And he says that this reflects the difference between the two brothers. This reflects something about their character. Because Tiberius was reasonable. He calls him reasonable and gentle. This is really important for what's coming up, because it was possible for enemies to describe Tiberius as this revolutionary firebrand. And I think Plutarch is laying this out at the beginning to say Tiberius wasn't like that. You would read from this that he's somebody open to negotiation. He's very measured in the way he does things. He thinks about the context and what the outcome might be, and he tries to bring people over to him. I think that's meant to be the implication here, that Tiberius is not someone who's quick to temper. He gives, and I have to say, Plutarch is giving a very positive vision of Tiberius here, and I think that's intentional. It's often we have dealt in this podcast with extremely negative representations of people from the past, and we've seen that as problematic because, well, did this person really do all of those terrible things, or are they being described like this because they were very unpopular after they died, or this person's biased in some way in the way they write? You could almost say that Plutarch is biased towards Tiberius a little bit because he seems so perfect in this biography. Yeah. I know you say I'm always going to find a problem with sources, but there's not much critique going on here, I'd say. Mm. Not of Tiberius, anyway.
The first thing that we get to quite early in his life, and I gather it is quite early in his life, is that he marries Claudia Pulchra.
Mm.
So who's Claudia Pulchra? It seems to be quite a good arranged marriage for him.
Yes, the Claudian family are hugely important. And she's the daughter of Appius Claudius, and they're a family that go way, way back. So if you read something like the early books of Livy, that family's there. They seem to have been important throughout the Republic. They're important political figures.
Yeah.
This is a marriage that is made, as you say, when both of them are quite young. It's Appius Claudius directly approaching Tiberius, because Tiberius's father is dead.
Yeah, so, I was about to ask that. So you go directly to the...
Well, unless there's another man who's sort of taken over as the paterfamilias. But
and
it seems
we never get that impression, yeah.
Well, yeah, because Cornelia seems to be in charge of this family, doesn't she?
Mm.
So
okay. Well, this is more affirmation of that. He goes straight to Tiberius.
He does. And we're told by Plutarch in The Life of Tiberius, chapter 4, Tiberius gladly accepted the invitation and the betrothal was thus arranged. And this is the nice little anecdote. When Appius returned home from the doorway where he stood, he called his wife and cried in a loud voice, "Antistia, I have betrothed our Claudia."
And she said, "Which one?"
Yes, there might have been more. It's true. And they'd all have been called Claudia.
I think there actually were four. So this was the second daughter.
Right.
This is the second Claudia in the family. The first one was a quite famous Vestal virgin.
Antistia seems to know which one he's talking about. She says, in amazement, "Why so eager? Why so fast? If thou hadst only found Tiberius Gracchus for betrothal to her."
Yes.
So she's waiting for him. So it seems to be a marriage that makes the parents, at least, extremely happy.
Mm.
And as I say, the Claudia are a very high-born, important family, and Antistia's reaction means that she has a very high regard for Tiberius Gracchus.
All right, so we now get a bit of military history for Tiberius, which is normal for a young man born during the...
Mid-Republic?
Punic Wars, I was going to say.
Ah, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, to sign up and go away to war.
Well, I mean, it's normal for a Roman
citizen
man, for a Roman citizen to be called into the army, but also for any Roman man who has a political aspirations, he's going to serve in the army. So it's not surprising that he becomes a military tribune and he is appointed on the staff of Scipio Aemilianus,
who is his brother-in-law.
Yeah, he's got good connections there. His sister Sempronia is married to him. So he gets to fight during the Third Punic War and to be there at the final taking of Carthage.
Yeah, well, Plutarch gives him a lot of credit for his bravery during that.
he says that he's the first to scale the walls. This is always something in Roman military narratives, isn't it? Who's the first to get over the wall, the bravest? I mean,
still would be that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah. In films today. Plutarch tells us that he's there with a man called Fannius, who's a historian, yes, as well as being a soldier. Fannius subsequently wrote a history of the Punic Wars in 8 books. We don't have any of it.
None of which we have.
No,
but it's always a good idea to, you know, scale the walls of Carthage in the accompaniment of a historian.
Just bring along a tame historian with you so you'll be remembered. Yes.
Okay, I'll remember that. If I ever, you know, decide Carthago delenda est, I'll take you with me.
I'm not tame.
True.
Although I would be terrified in any military encounter.
But you will write my propaganda if you know it's good for you. Yeah.
What Plutarch tells us about this part of Tiberius's life is interesting as well.
Yeah.
And also very, I don't want to quite say rose-tinted because I don't think it's a lie, but it's all extremely positive. He's so popular with the army. He's somebody who at this point we can see connects with ordinary people. Somebody who's as brave as they are. Somebody who'll take on the same dangers as they are.
Yeah.
It's sort of a truism, but that's something that gains you the respect of the other soldiers. So it's no surprise that he starts upon a political career and continues his military career now. So he's elected as a quaestor, going up the rungs of the Roman cursus honorum, the career ladder for an elite Roman man.
Mm-hmm.
And he serves in another war over in the west in Numantia in Spain, serving under the consul of the time, Gaius Mancinus, who Plutarch does not really approve of. Well, he kind of says this consul of 137 BCE was not bad as a man, but the most unfortunate of Romans as a general.
Mm.
So it sort of implies he's unlucky there, I suppose, or he's just not a very good general.
Well, I mean, you know, the job description for being a general is must be consul for the year at the time, isn't it?
If you're consul, then you have the right to go lead an army, absolutely. And
you're expected to go lead an army.
Yes, yeah. It would be expected, you're quite right.
So you don't need to have tactics or anything like that. You've just got to be of the rank. And I guess, you know.
Well, it's interesting. It seems to me that there's a lot of talk about Scipio in particular being military geniuses.
Mm.
And maybe it's around this time that it starts to become important that you have good strategy. And some people would say that it's Hannibal who forced them into that in the Second Punic War.
Yes.
So maybe there's still a bit of anachronism going on here that if you're consul, you get to lead the army rather than, if you're somebody with talents in that direction,
you get
to lead the army.
Yes, yeah. The camp that Tiberius is in is taken by the Numantines, and they equally seem to have had not a very good opinion of the consul, and they would only deal with Tiberius.
Yes. The reason Plutarch gives is that Tiberius's father had had some interaction with them, and they had good memories of him as being somebody who's very just and had integrity.
Mm.
So the Numantines want to show this respect they have for Tiberius, the son, that they give him back his records and they offer any spoils that had been taken, but Tiberius only took the records. All right, so this presents Tiberius as somebody who has great integrity. Plutarch says he took nothing except the frankincense, which he was wont to use in the public sacrifices, and after bidding them farewell with every expression of friendship, he departed.
Yes.
And I have to say, for Plutarch writing centuries later, there has to be, in his mind and his reader's mind, a setting up of a contrast with the common practice, particularly during the late Republic, for generals to just take whatever spoils they want and keep them for themselves. All right, so he's trying to point out that Tiberius is a more old-fashioned kind of Roman.
Yes.
Has morals and is upright.
Very gracious in defeat. Mm. So Tiberius has signed the peace treaty with the Numanites,
mm-hmm,
which isn't something that somebody of his level normally would have done.
No, it's meant to be the consul's in charge here. He should be doing this. This is very controversial back in Rome. And they think that it makes them look weak, that he signed this treaty rather than fighting on. But his supporters and many of the family members of soldiers say, well, he saved a lot of lives by making this treaty.
Mm.
The Senate demands that Mancinus be sent back to Numantia in chains. Like, take him back, we don't want him, almost.
He's such a disgrace to us. Yeah.
Mancinus accepts this, but the Numantines don't want him. They refuse him as a prisoner. So the whole thing is a bit of a political schmozzle, I suppose. And Tiberius Gracchus has acted in the way that he thought was right. He's acted with integrity, but he's come up against the Roman establishment.
Now, Plutarch tells us that Scipio Aemilianus actually doesn't support this treaty that Tiberius signed, but is very supportive of Tiberius as a person.
It indicates that Scipio is a kind of stickler for the rules, but also somebody who will stand by a person, I suppose, that there's this distinction in Scipio's mind.
Mm.
And Plutarch's building up to the idea that what happens to Tiberius, the way he meets his fate, only occurred because Scipio wasn't there.
All right, so now that we've talked about his military career, it would be good to talk about land ownership problems. And I think that that's one of the very few times that that sentence has been spoken. It's probably also worth noting that we did talk about this to some extent just before episode 100. There is other detail back then, but also let's go over it here.
And it's very complicated, and there are ancient historians kind of still debate exactly what was going on here.
Well, what was the problem with land ownership? And I guess the good way to set this out was that this was a problem with soldiers, who can only be soldiers if they own land, going away to war, and that there being so many wars that in the meantime they lose the farm.
Yeah, it's partly that, and it's partly a problem of the amount of land that the Romans have gained through conquest and what gets done with it. The result of it was that some people, rich people, Roman elites, were gaining huge amounts of land at the expense of what is often at least translated as peasant farmers, who are also soldiers, because if you own any land and you're a Roman citizen, then you also fight in the military at this point. Their amount of land is decreasing. Some of them lose their land completely, so they end up as landless poor, which means they can't fight in the army, by definition. We have this problem of the rich getting richer and owning more land, and land is what is seen as wealth by the Romans, and the poor getting poorer, not being able to provide for themselves. Eventually, more and more of them will end up in the city. And they want land, and there isn't land that they can afford or get their hands on. Now, how they'd got to this stage is a little bit contentious, but Appian has one explanation that seems to work quite well. He says, and this is in Book 1 of the Civil Wars, Chapter 7, the Romans, as they subdued the Italian people, so as they conquered Italy successively in war, used to seize a part of their lands and build towns there, or to enroll colonists of their own to occupy those already existing. So they get Romans and put them in towns that already exist and ones they've conquered. And their idea was to use these as outposts. But of the land acquired by war, they assigned the cultivated part to the colonists or sold and leased it. So they've got all this land, and some of it they put people on straight away. But Appian says, some of it which lay desolated by war, which he says was generally the greater part, they didn't know what to do with it. So they made a proclamation that in the meantime, those who were willing to work it might do so for a toll of the yearly crops. So they can go and work it. They give a tenth of their grain and a fifth of their fruit to the Roman state.
But they don't own it.
But they don't own it. They sort of own it just by being there. But yes, it's a little bit contentious. They did these things in order to multiply the Italian race, which they considered the most hardworking of people, so they might have plenty of allies at home. But, he says, the very opposite thing happened for the rich getting possession of the greater part of the undistributed lands. Doesn't really explain quite how that happened, but it happened. He knew the effect of it. And being emboldened by the lapse of time to believe that they would never be dispossessed, absorbing any adjacent strips and their poor neighbours' allotments, partly by purchase under persuasion and partly by force, came to cultivate vast tracts instead of single estates, using slaves as labourers and herdsmen. And that's important. However it happened initially, and this would certainly explain part of it, the rich have now got huge tracts of land and they can work these huge farms, which they call latifundia, broad farms, with slaves.
Yeah.
And the slaves are part of Tiberius Gracchus' argument. He uses this against them. He says, you know, you've got slaves working there. We've got free Romans who aren't able to work anywhere. They've got no land to work. He kind of sets up the Roman people against the slaves in a way, which is an interesting debating point to use. So even though he is going to be taking on the landed rich, he uses the fact that there are slaves working there against them. So that part of it is very significant. So this is the problem. We've got a lot of dispossessed people with no land. Tiberius wants to try and solve that problem.
The other problem is war going on for so long, soldiers going off their farms to go and fight, and you've got to stay for a full campaign. In the meantime, you lose the farm back home. And Plutarch's written, "Then the poor who had been ejected from their land no longer showed themselves eager for military service and neglecting the bringing up of children, so that soon all Italy was conscious of a dearth of freemen and was filled with gangs of foreign slaves, by whose aid the rich cultivated their estate from which they had driven away the free citizens."
Yes. So you can see that Plutarch is there working in that. The slaves are filling in the jobs that we should have, or filling in the land that we should have. And what Plutarch there makes sense in terms of the initial problem might have been created by this free Italian land that is sort of just given away for people to work.
Yeah.
But he's quite right that the problem of having this system whereby if you own some land, then you also fight in the army is fine if you go away for a certain part of the year and then you come back and work your farm. But because these wars are now lasting years and years and years, the farm gets run down. That means it gets sold off quite cheaply. That means the rich buy it up and their estates get bigger. And when the soldier comes back, there's nowhere for him to come to. And where's his family getting their food from in the meantime?
So Tiberius Gracchus isn't the first person to have these ideas and to try and reform this problem, is he?
No. So there is a previously existing law, in fact, and what Tiberius Gracchus is going to try and do is to enforce this law and build on it. And the law is that nobody should own more than 500 jugera of land, which is apparently about 300 acres. And there should only be a certain number of cattle and sheep that you can pasture on them.
Right.
So there is a law, but it's being flouted quite openly.
Mm. So why does Tiberius take up this cause then? Because while this sort of reform would be popular with the people, especially the unemployed, unwashed masses in Rome at the time, it's not going to be popular with the powerful people who get to make the decisions.
Yeah, and this is the one part where Plutarch does suggest that Tiberius might not be squeaky clean, although he also gives positive motives for this.
Yeah.
So he says, and we're in about chapter 8 of his biography, about halfway through, some people say that Cornelia was to blame because she wanted fame through her children.
Mm.
She's annoyed, according to this, because the Romans are calling her the mother-in-law of Scipio, not yet the mother of the Gracchi. This seems like a ridiculous argument and one that's based on what she becomes later known as, which is definitely after the fact of both her sons being murdered, I think.
Mm.
Others again say, I think this is interesting psychologically if it were true, that a certain Spurius Postumius was to blame. And the idea here is that Spurius was sort of similar age to Tiberius, but Tiberius came back from the army and found that Spurius Postumius was an object of public admiration. He was a great orator and he'd been sort of building a following. Mm. So this is a kind of competition based on popularity contest back at Rome. And so he says, well, I'll take on a really bold political measure and make my name.
Yeah.
This implies he's sort of attention grabbing. Actually, both of those do. Is he doing it because his mum bullies him into being attention grabbing, or is he doing it because there's some kind of peer rivalry going on?
I notice that Plutarch doesn't say, or option three, he believed in the cause.
Yeah. I guess maybe this implies it. He says that Gaius wrote in a pamphlet that Tiberius had sort of cottoned on to these problems as he was on his way out with the army. He passed through Tuscany in northern Italy, and he observed, to quote, the dearth of inhabitants in the country and that those who tilled the soil were barbarian slaves. So this is something he's actually seen by observation.
Okay, so it sounds like a bit of myth-making. This is the dramatic backstory as peddled by Gaius.
Yeah, and then he first conceived the public policy at that point. So the third one is, I think what would probably speaks to us more maybe, is a kind of personal observation of socioeconomic change here. And I have to say, well, it's possible. It's possible that happened. But I don't think there would be anybody in Rome who didn't know this was happening.
Yes.
It's just that it wasn't in the interests of most of the senators to do anything about it because they were the ones who owned those vast tracts of land.
Mm.
This is a political problem that we still have, I believe, in different configurations.
Yeah, and I think we said this last year that this is all sounding uncannily familiar. Okay, so the solution that Tiberius Gracchus puts forward is not one that he comes up with by himself. He recruits a few of his friends, including his father-in-law and his brother, I think.
Yes.
He is going to enforce the limitation on the lands that can be owned by an individual, and the excess gets sold back to the state.
And it's called the Lake Sempronia Agraria. So Lake's his law. Sempronia is named after him.
Mm-hmm.
And Agraria is about land.
So Tiberius Gracchus's land law.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Laws are usually named after the person who makes the law.
So. Now we just call it T. Gracchus v. the state.
Well, it's not meant to be that, but it kind of ends up as it.
Yeah.
And this is where Tiberius starts to show his rhetorical skills and to make the argument that we're denying freeborn Roman citizens their patrimony, their land.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great speech in Plutarch. There's a lot of great speeches, but one where Tiberius says, "The wild beasts that roam over Italy have their dens. Each has a place of repose and refuge. But the men who fight and die for Italy enjoy nothing but the air and light. Without house or home, they wander about with their wives and children."
Mm.
So we treat them worse than the animals.
But the important context around that speech is that he's standing on the rostra before a crowd, so he's not presenting his argument for the Senate. He's taking it directly to the people, going, "Look, you guys are being wronged. I have here my law, which is going to solve all your problems."
This is not the only time he does that. This is kind of, you could call it the publicity stunt as he's bringing the law in.
Mm.
But we'll see in other contexts when Tiberius runs into trouble with the Senate, he goes back to the people.
Yeah.
And I think this is really important because this is something that Tiberius is willing to do, which other politicians haven't necessarily done. And Plutarch tells us there have been attempts, he doesn't tell us much about them, but attempts to deal with this land problem before, but the Senate has disapproved, so they sort of just floated away.
Mm.
And Tiberius isn't put off by that. He's starting to take his power from the people. You can see the beginning of the development of a word we talked about when we were talking about the decline of the Republic, that word popularis, which isn't applied to Tiberius, partly because our sources are in Greek, but the people it's applied to later are sort of trying to deal with the same issues and doing the same thing, getting their power from the people.
So the idea is that this land that is confiscated is given back to the poor and the homeless of Rome, but also to veterans.
Yep.
So it would also in the same way boost the men that are eligible for military service. So it'd kind of deal with a couple of problems there.
Exactly, because as I mentioned before, the problem of being landless is that at this point, and it doesn't change until the following century,
yep,
you need to have land to be eligible to fight.
Mm.
So it's in the interests of the Roman elite who want to make their names by leading armies to give land to people so that they can have those armies.
Yes, exactly, yeah. So it's a win-win situation for everyone except for the rich.
Yeah.
And therein lies the problem. All right, so death of Tiberius Gracchus. Let's go. That's Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review. As always, it's very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook. You can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, Tiberius Gracchus learns just how far the Senate will take things. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.